In this presentation, I will summarize the work of the past 5 years about, the idea of testing generativity in the strong field regime with black hole X-ray data. I have a few slides of introduction. So we want to test generativity in the strong field regime. Generativity is surely one of the pillars of modern physics. It has been extensively tested with solar system experiment and observational binary pulsar, which mainly test the so-called weak field regime. So the system can be described as a Newtonian system plus some small corrections. And we want to measure these small corrections and see if they are consistent with the prediction of generativity. In the past 20 years, there have been significant effort even to test generativity on large scales with cosmological tests, in part even for the problem of dark matter and dark energy. And more recently, we can test also generativity in the strong field regime with black holes and neutron stars. Today we can use gravitational waves, black hole imaging. These are very popular. And in my presentation, we'll discuss X-ray data, which is not as popular. I mean, this line of research is not as popular as gravitational waves and black hole imaging test, but I will show you that for the moment, these tests are very competitive. And so basically, if you consider only 10 years ago, there were not many observations about of black holes that could really be used for testing generative in the strong field regime. On the other hand, in the past 10 years, there have been at least these three lines of research. Black holes, in generativity, there are some theorems which are actually a family of theorems. In the end, black holes are completely described by a few parameters, mass, spin, and electric charge. Of course, there are some assumptions. And if you consider macroscopic object, the electric charge is normally negligible. So black holes are described as this Kerr solution. So you have only the mass and the spin. You can question whether this ideal Kerr solution can describe well the space-time around an astrophysical black hole. You can quantify possible deviations from the Kerr solution, for example, because the black hole, the Kerr solution is a stationary solution. Real black hole, formed from the gravitational collapse of some progenitor star or some progenitor body. Then there may be an accretion disk, there may be some stars around. You can quantify these deviations from the Kerr metric, but in the end, if you want to probe the region around the black holes, these deviations are extremely small and actually completely negligible for present and future tests. So if you believe in standard physics, you expect that the space-time around an astrophysical black hole is described well by the Kerr solution. If you consider models beyond generativity, this is not true any longer, and this is just some names. For example, generativity may not be the correct theory of gravity. You can have modified theory of gravity. There is the possibility of a macroscopic quantum gravity effect already at the near the black hole event horizon. In the end, the no hard theorems hold under specific assumptions. So in the case of exotic matter field, actually, you can also have deviations from the Kerr solution. Anyway, this is, in the end, some scenarios that we want to test. So I enter the details actually about this test with X-ray data. And this is the system that we want to study. So we have a black hole. The black hole can be a stellar mass black hole in an X-ray binary system or a supermassive black hole in an active galactic nucleus. doesn't matter. Important, very crucial point is that there is this geometrically thin and optically thick accretion disk. And this requires that the gas has a large angular momentum, and the mass accretion rate is between, say, 5% to 20-30% of the identity limit of a source. So every point on the accretion disk emits a blackbody-like spectrum. And if you consider the whole disk, it is a multi-temperature blackbody spectrum because the temperature of the material increases as it falls onto a black hole. The thermal spectrum of a disk is normally peaked in the soft X-ray band for stellar mass black holes and in the UV band for supermassive black holes. The disk is cold because it can efficiently emit radiation. Then there is this corona, which is some hot gas near the black hole. Hot because the temperature can be something like 100 keV. Here there are some ideas about coronal geometry. So it may be the base of a jet, so in this case the lamppost corona. It may be hot atmosphere above the accretion disk. You have this sandwich corona. It may be the material in the plunging region between the inner edge of the disk and the black hole. Anyway, the corona is some hot gas near the black hole and the inner part of the accretion disk. So for this reason, thermal photon from the disk can inverse Compton scatter of free electrons in the corona. And we have this Comptonized photon. The spectrum of a Comptonized photon can be approximated normally with a power law and exponential cutoff. The Comptonized photon can also illuminate the disk. Here we have Compton scattering and absorption followed by fluorescent emission. And the result is the reflection spectrum. So the reflection spectrum in the frame of the material in the disk is characterized by narrow fluorescent emission lines in the soft X-ray band. And then there is a Compton amp around 20-30 keV, depending on the ionization of the gas. This is in the frame of the material in the disk. If you consider the reflection spectrum far from the source of the whole disk, well, different point of accretion disk have a different redshift, Doppler boosting and gravitational redshift. So in the end, the result is that you see a blur spectrum just because of a different redshift from different point of accretion disk. And actually, what we want to study in the end, I mean, is the shape of this blurred spectrum. So we want to analyze data. I mean, just we need a theoretical model with some parameters. Then we fit the theoretical model with the data. I mean, to determine the parameters of a system. And so, how can we calculate the thermal spectrum and reflection spectrum? So you have this setup. Here we have a corona, disk, and observer. So step one is okay. If you assume some coronal geometry, you know the properties of the corona, you fire photons from the corona to the disk, and you see how the corona illuminates the disk. This is to determine the emissivity profile. And typically here you have, I mean, the standard case, you have the Kerr metric, and you have to solve the geodesic equation of photons in the Kerr metric. So basically it's a ray tracing calculation. Then you need to calculate the reflection spectrum in the frame of the material in the disk. In this case, here there is atomic physics. And you need typically to solve some radiative transfer equation. And then at the end of this step two, you have a reflection spectrum at every point of the disk, every radius, because in the end, I mean, you assume axis symmetry. And then you calculate the redshift image. So you fire photon from the distant observer to the disk. Well, actually, in principle, the photon is emitted from the disk and detected by the distant observer. But I mean, you can calculate backward in time the photon trajectory. You calculate the redshift, and then you have at every point of the disk from step two, you add the spectrum. And then, I mean, you can every spectrum has its own redshift, so in every pixel would have its own spectrum. You integrate, and then you get the spectrum. So here there are there are a lot of ingredients, some about fundamental physics and some related to the astrophysical part of a setup. So about the astrophysical part, you need a model for the accretion disk. So you need to know the surface, the location of the surface of accretion disk, the inner edge of a disk, and the motion of the material in the disk. And but you need also some model for the corona. And then there are these ingredients related to fundamental physics. So you need to know the motion of photons and massive particles in the space-time. And you need to know atomic physics. So the idea is, okay, how can we, what can we test with these systems? So this is the standard case. I mean, the standard case, the motion of particle is regulated by geodesic motion in the Kerr space-time. You can consider violation of this statement, and well, you can assume, for example, still geodesic motion, but you can test different space-times, which makes sense. I mean, in generativity, black hole, uncharged black holes are described by Kerr solution. You can test other theories of gravity in which uncharged black holes are not described by Kerr solution. Or, I mean, you can also relax the assumption of geodesic motion. You can test the weak equivalence principle, basically. So you can check if the particles follow the geodesic of a space-time. So you may have a situation in which, for example, photons follows the geodesic of a Kerr metric, but the particles in the disk do not, or the opposite. And then you can also test atomic physics in the strong gravitational field. In generativity, this is, atomic physics in the strong gravitational field is the same as atomic physics in your laboratory on Earth, simply because the gravitational field is described only by the metric tensor. So you can always perform a coordinate transformation, and locally, the non-gravitational physics is the same as, is the physics of special relativity. However, this is not necessarily true in extension of, in theories beyond general relativity. Typically, you may have situation which, for example, some fundamental constants are different. The simplest case is you have a scalar field whose vacuum expectation velo provide, for example, the velo of a fine structure constant, the velo of electron mass. And in this case, basically, you change atomic physics because you change the atomic energy level. And potentially, this is something that you can test. So in the past years, as I said, we developed these models. They are called RexLNK and NKBB. I mean, the name is just some names. RexLNK is to test fundamental physics from the analysis of a reflection spectrum, and NKBB for the thermal spectrum. We use these models for testing the Kerr metric, which is the simplest kind of test. And these models are available on GitHub. So here I have strategy. In the sense, this is not true for tests of generativity. This is true for testing any theory. But anyway, you have two options, which normally are called theory-specific approach or top-down approach or agnostic approach and bottom-up approach. So the theory-specific approach is that you want to test generativity against some other theory of gravity. So in this case, you construct two theoretical models, one for generativity, one for the other theory of gravity. You fit your data with these two models, and you see if, you use some statistical tool to conclude, if one of them explain the data better than the other one, or I mean, put some constraint on some parameter. For example, if typically there is an extra, at least one more parameter in the theory beyond the generativity, in which at some level you recover generativity. And I mean, this is probably the most logical one. The main problem is that, I mean, you need to be able to, you need to be able to predict to derive the predictions of these theories beyond generativity. So, for example, in the case of test of the Kerr metric, in generativity, you know, rotating black hole solution are described by the Kerr metric. You need to know also the rotating black hole solution in another theory of gravity, which is not so easy normally. Normally, I mean, it is relatively easy to find the non-rotating black hole solution. Sometimes you have the rotating solution in the slow rotation limit, but I mean, normally, I mean, you don't have a complete rotating black hole solution in theories beyond generativity. So in this case, I mean, it is difficult to use this approach. In the past years, I mean, many people have tried this kind of agnostic approach, in which you try just to create a framework in which you can quantify possible deviation from generativity. And then, I mean, typically you introduce some extra parameters, these deformation parameters. And I mean, you want to measure this deformation parameter and see if they are consistent with the prediction of generativity. So this agnostic approach is the approach of a PPM formalism, which has been very successful for solar system experiment. So in the case of a solar system experiment, you want to test the Schwarzschild solution in the weak field limit. You don't want to make an assumption, so you write the most general line element for a spherically symmetric and static spacetime. So you expand your metric in m over r, because m over r is the natural expansion parameter, m the mass of the sun, r the radial coordinate. Then, I mean, in GTT, you have 1 to recover flat spacetime, then 2 m over r to recover the correct Newtonian limit, and then you continue your expansion, but you parametrize your ignorance with this beta. And you do also the same for the GXX, GYY, and GZZ term. So you have this gamma. Yeah, you introduce just some parameter, I mean, to parametrize this term of expansion. And then you want to measure beta and gamma from experiment. And this is what people have done. And today, I mean, we have this constraint. So beta and gamma are 1 at the level of 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5. If you write the Schwarzschild solution in isotropic coordinate, beta and gamma are exactly 1. So the conclusion is that, okay, you tested the Schwarzschild solution in the weak field limit at the level, I mean, within the precision of current experiment. And this is something that, I mean, you would like to do something similar, for example, for Kerr, but I mean, in general, you can repeat this, I mean, for any prediction. The Kerr solution is one of the predictions, but I mean, you can repeat even for other predictions of generativity. In the case of a Kerr solution, it is more complicated because you cannot use an expansion m over r any longer, because m over r is not a small parameter. And I mean, there are many proposals in the literature. Every proposal has its advantage and disadvantage. Here I have an example, because I mean, just I have to show an example, consider an example. And it is the Janssen metric. As I said, I mean, with some advantage and disadvantage with respect to other proposals. But in the end, I mean, we have a metric which is more general than the Kerr solution, and they include the Kerr solution as a special case. There are these deformation parameters. Actually, there is an infinite number of deformation parameters. And if you set all the deformation parameter to 0, you recover exactly the Kerr solution. So in the end, I mean, the spirit is the same as the PPN formalism. And these are two examples. I mean, on the left, it is a reflection spectrum. and on the right a thermal spectrum. So in this case, I mean, we have a model, this for Rex and K and KBB, I mean, this is the name of the two models. For the reflect, basically you fix all the other parameters of a model, and you change only, in this case, we consider only, for simplicity, only one deformation parameter, alpha 1, 3, which is, I mean, the leading order term, but I mean, this is just, I mean, we consider just one deformation parameter. And I mean, you see that you change the space-time geometry. This has an impact on the spectrum, actually, on both of it.
So one question here. So part of this is the effect of the propagation of the photons over the space-time geometry. But what do you do with the disk? I mean, for every choice of the formation of curve, you saw
yes.
The stationary disk configuration should be, or you keep putting the same disk?
No, I change the disk because this disk, in this, these are Keplerian disk. So the gas follow the geodesic of the space-time. So you change the motion of the gas in the disk, and you change also the location of the inner edge of the disk because you change the innermost elliptical orbit.
But is the disk like profile also being varied here?
So in this here we use the Novikov-Thor model, which is a very popular model for the descriptor of geometrically thin and optically thick disk. And the disk is infinitesimally thin on the equatorial plane. We have also a model in which we consider a disk of fine thickness. But here, I mean, typically, I mean, not only for test of generativity, even for standard case, you want to measure the spin. I mean, the models assume an infinitesimally thin disk.
And what's the key difference here? So suppose they do the exercise, which just told me you don't do that, but suppose they don't change the disk, because after all, you assume everything is stationary, and then you so you take the profile of the disk as if it were a curve, but then, so I'm just trying to say, what's the larger effect, the effect of the photon propagating off the space and it's slightly different, or the structure of the resulting disk, so what, I'm just trying to say, which has more mass?
This depends on the parameters of the system. Typically, I would say the former, in the sense the structure of the accretion disk. Actually, we did this sort of exercise because in a work we considered the possibility that well of violation of the weak equivalence principle. So we considered the Kerr metric for the particle in the disk and a deformed Kerr metric for the photons, or the opposite. So it depends on the answer is it depends on the parameters of the system, but typically the structure of the accretion disk is more important, especially the location of the innermost elliptical orbit.
Could I ask, so the vertical structure in the accretion disk is trivial because it's thin. I understand the dynamical structure of the accretion disk is sorted by the geodesics in the equatorial plane. But one thing that seems very uncertain and seems like it might have a non-trivial impact on the reflection spectrum is the geometry and dynamics of the corona. So, So how big an impact does that have relative to the variations we see here? And how would one think about trying to build a self-consistent corona model? Do you have a self-consistent corona model, or are you just painting those in a lamppost or something?
Well, I mean, the uncertainty of corona, of course, is an issue. And also, to understand the corona is a hot topic. typically, you don't assume a specific coronal geometry, but you assume some phenomenological emissivity profile, like a power law, broken power law, twice broken power law, of course. So basically, you fit the data with these phenomenological emissivity profiles to try to model the emissivity profile, because in the end, I mean, the geometry of the corona is not very important. It's important how the corona illuminates the disk. And otherwise, you can also consider some specific coronal geometry. I mean, lamp post, but even, I mean, a disk like corona, I mean, a more complicated corona.
So in some sense, what you're gonna present is gonna be marginalized over different potential corona
yes.
geometries.
Okay. Yes. Okay. What I can say is that there are some studies, not by my group, but I mean, in which they claim that if you use a broken power law or a twice broken power law, basically such a model for emissivity profiling is general enough to mimic well most of the coronal geometry. Personally, I think, well, it depends probably on the quality of the data. For current data, it is fine, but my feeling is that if you consider high quality data like, I mean, next generation of X-ray emission, in which, I mean, you will have a better statistics because the effective area will be larger. I'm skeptical that the twice broken power law can fit well the data. But yes, it is an important issue, of course, the geometry of the corona.
There's a known interior solution. It's contract with the fluid. But there's no known interior solution for the rotating stock body. So there could be many vacuum solutions associated with it.
Yes.
Interior solution, a black hole. But, so we choose to look at the drug solution because it's the simplest. But it's not unique as far as the exterior.
Yes, of course.
So how does this affect when you're doing?
I mean, the problem is that, for example, you can consider a neutron star. The problem is that in the end, the spin of a neutron star is very close to one, is very close to zero, in the sense deviation from Schwarzschild are small. And for this reason, basically, you cannot distinguish the exterior of a neutron star from Schwarzschild. But assuming you have very high quality data, and yes, you could distinguish Kerr from a deformed Kerr.
So much you find an interior solution.
I mean, here, of course, you measure only the exterior solution.
I spent time and gave up.
Okay.
Well, let's continue the talk in that case.
Okay, so basically here the key point is that, I mean, if you deform the metric, you have this has an impact on the spectrum. So modulo degeneracy among the parameters, you can understand that, I mean, you fit the data, you can constrain these deformation parameters. And well, these are basically results. So we have a model, we plug this Johansen metric with this deformation parameter alpha 1,3 for simplicity. And I mean, we use the model to analyze data. Actually, there are many data in archive. So if you analyze the thermal spectrum, this is a typical result. This is, in the plot, there is the specific case of LMCX1, which is a stellar mass black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud. We use RXT data. And there are many parameters in the model. I don't know, probably, I mean, this case, not so many, but maybe 7, 8, something like this. We marginalize over all other parameters. And the plot on the left is the constraint on the spin parameter, deformation parameter plane. And typically, you obtain this banana shape. For these are the contour level of a chi-square. You obtain this banana shape because there is a degeneracy between the spin and the deformation parameter. And this is because the thermal spectrum has a very simple shape. it is just a multi-temperature black body spectrum. So you are mainly sensitive to the location of a innermost elliptical orbit. And for this reason, I mean, you have this, the genesis. I mean, the end of the location of the inner edge is just one, and you have two parameters. On the end, if you consider the reflection spectrum, has a, well, there are also more parameters, but it has also a more elaborated shape. And there is still clearly a correlation. Here on the left, there is a spin parameter versus this deformation parameter alpha 1,3. On the right, we consider another deformation parameter, alpha 2,2. But anyway, the spirit is the same. So there is for sure, a correlation between the spin and the possible deviation from the Kerr solution. But if you have high quality data, you can break this degeneracy. And at least you can reduce the allowed region, even if, there is a correlation, because here there is, diagonal or anti-correlation, which is the same.
So just to make sure that I'm following, so if you assume GR, and you're saying that for this object, the spin has been measured to be 0.97.
Yes.
With some tiny error bar.
What is the question?
Yes, the claim is that the spin is measured really well, and the spin is almost maximal.
If I assume generativity, so zero deformation parameter,
yes,
you can measure the spin well.
That seems like a very strong statement.
MCG 3015 is the poster child for X-ray iron K alpha lines.
So is this like widely accepted in the community?
It's widely accepted in the community that people have been doing this and making these claims for a very long time. I think it's probably high spin.
It doesn't have to be correct.
What?
You're saying the claims must be made for hard time, but do we believe those things?
You can, of course, try to estimate also the extra systematic uncertainty, but in any case, it is true. If the spin is very high, typically the uncertainty is small, because it changes very quickly. The innermost elliptical orbit changes very quickly. If the spin is low, it is a completely different story. Maybe you can have also an uncertainty of 100%. It is 0.2 plus minus 0.2. But for very high spin, in the end, the uncertainty is small.
This is a supermassive black hole, right?
Yes.
It's accreting at Eddington or Super Eddington? Is it known or
unknown? No, it is accreting around 20-30. Well, it changes, but around 20. It should accrete around 20-30% of Eddington limit.
Because you also have a paper yourself that you say that for Eddington accreting supermassive black holes, you can change the basic model to these polished donuts, which I'm not familiar with. But in that paper, you say that then the posterior that you get for the spin depends widely on this model that you...
This is true, because, the point is that, this RELXLNK, but any reflection model on the market assume this Novikov-Thorn disk, in which the disk is geometrically thin and optically thick. If you fit, if you use this model to fit data of a black hole creating at the Eddington limit, the disk is not thin any longer. So it is obvious that you can obtain very large systematic uncertainty.
And it's absolutely certain that this disk is not accreting near Eddington?
We think. Of course, it depends also on... it is difficult to estimate the mass and the distance of supermassive black holes.
Right.
So here,
how is the mass estimated for this guy?
I don't know, honestly.
Sigma is calibrated to non-aging galaxies, is it?
I don't know how this is, in this case, they measure the... there are several techniques.
Right.
And yes, I mean, of course, it depends on. I mean, it is possible also that there are a systematic effect that, I mean, we don't know, of course.
But 20 to 30% Eddington is pretty far from the ADAF cutoff, like 1%, right? So, I mean, I think if you wanted to say that it was a thick disk, you'd have a lot of things to explain, right? And the spectrum of this, I don't know if you have a picture of it. You know, it's a pretty striking red edge on the line. I mean, that's why it's the poster child. They've been doing this for...
Yes, this was the very first black hole for which it was detected a broad arrow line in 1995.
Yeah. So anything else you would do, you'd have to explain how the inner edge of the you know the fluorescent zone was so redshifted, right? You're not going to do that with low spin unless you have some magic way of supporting material deep inside the innermost stable circular orbit. So the answer is, do I believe it? In this case, yeah, I believe it's high. You know, I mean, maybe you can push it around a little bit. And there are technical questions.
Would be the uncertainty, right?
So this uncertainty, what do you assume about the continuum and things like that? That's where the technical issues would be.
The continuum from the corona. Because the thermal spectrum here is in the UV band, so
right.
There is no thermal spectrum.
Yeah.
Here we have the continuum from the corona, normally can be approximated well by power law, so there are no particular, I mean, it is just a photon index that you fit with the data.
So this is actually pretty, I think it's pretty secure, right? I mean, for X-ray binding, you worry about breaks because the continuum from the thermal spectrum are right under the line. But unless you want to put a spectral break in the continuum emission right at 6.1 keV.
But if there were significant, like, you know, mass inside the ISCO, wouldn't that then generate lots of highly redshifted emission?
Significant disk?
Well,
like,
well,
reflecting mass? Like, because there is a mass, it's the black hole.
The
disk inner edge matters, right? So people have
So if I ran some GRMHD simulation, do you know would I find a disk with some like edge at the ISCO, or instead is there just a continuum of mass flowing in?
Inside the ISCO, the mass doesn't live for very long.
Just plunges
on an orbit or two orbits, right? So people have done those. It costs them, I apologize. You can speak.
It's just for my education.
I think the real question is, what's the torque boundary condition at the inner edge? How much does that infalling gas pull and push on the gas right around it, modifying the Kepler rotation at the inner edge? I think the answer is in disks. It's small.
Quasi-normal mode. You mean quasi-normal mode of gravitational waves?
Yes.
I mean, of course, it is. But basically, you don't expect a quasi-normal mode from this system.
I was just trying to say, if you had a system where you could get all the things, but also I'm going to use. Suppose Lisa is going to fly in 23.
Okay.
So you're going to end up getting gravitational waves from a system which has similar mass.
Presumably, yes. Except the correlation between alpha-1-3 and the spin is exactly the same, you should be able to have some other allowed region with a different shape.
Right, but then you translate the
reflection
of the two plots, because this is not happening in the back.
two ways are being measured, right? So eventually you put all things in the same plot and just want to know if it will help.
Well, I mean, this should be for the same source.
I don't care. If I have a black hole of the same mass and same speed, I can have it possible or not. When you're going to say nature is going to give me a black hole here that has these properties and here a different property,
how do you know alpha?
I mean,
between all the systems.
No, I just want to know. Well, again, if I have a system with the same mass and the same speed, I would not expect.
Then, because you assume some form of a no higher theorems.
No, I just think that nature is not jerking us around, right? So if I have a mass, two black holes, they have the same mass and same speed, you're going to believe that this one has an alpha 1-3 that is different from this alpha.
I mean, in this case, this is the Janssen metric, and there is no theory behind.
But
in principle, yes, there may be some other charge. In which, I mean, a black hole is different from another.
The question that I wanted to ask at the end, and so maybe I'll just pose it now and you can answer it at the end unless you want to now, is that people are moving towards dynamical spectra where you measure this as a function of time. So there's like a change in the corona and you see how it lands on the disk. And that means you're doing lensing measurements between the corona and the disk and to the observer. And I wonder if that, because all your high-order quasi-normal modes are really just measurements of massless particle orbits, if that might break the degeneracy in this source. And so now this question about alpha 1-3 being universal becomes moot because you can do it all in one source, but not necessarily with quasi-normal modes. So maybe the dynamical, if you could speak to that, I'll let you do in the answer period so you can move on.
I mean, no, in the sense, in the case of X-ray reverberation, in the sense you measure this dynamical behavior, the evolution of a spectrum, the point is that it is extremely important, the geometry of the corona, rather than, I mean, the effect of the space-time is just some tiny, and the geometry of the corona is very important. So, I mean, if you know perfectly the geometry of the corona, and you have the photon count is large enough, of course you have more information. But you need to have a perfect knowledge of the geometry of a corona and also a very high statistic, because otherwise, I mean.
Your interesting talk raises a lot of questions. So I have another question.
John? Given that there's only 15 minutes left, can we ask this question at the end? Would that be okay?
So, shall I ask or wait?
Let's let Cosimo get through what he can get through in 15 minutes, and then...
Okay.
What? Okay.
Reflecting together with star collapses, that's first shown by Oppenheimer's spectrum, 39. The redshift, competition redshift, increases exponentially fast.
Okay.
You never actually see the horizon fall as an external observer. It falls in the instrument of the future. So if you have these disk objects and close to this, how are they behaving as they're close to the horizon in view of this? The star, what you're looking at is a collapsing star.
So
a frozen star, as Russia said.
I think that's a question that maybe we should answer after.
Okay. Okay, so I arrive here at the summary about X-ray gravitational wave and black hole imaging of this alpha 1-3, which I summarize here. So the horizontal line is alpha 1-3 equals 0, which is Kerr. And then there are the error bars, I mean, here there are measurements. So in green, I distinguish stellar mass black holes and supermass black holes, because in principle we probe different physics, and because the curvature is different, so in principle the physics is different. So in the case of stellar mass black holes, I have in green there are the best constraint from the analysis of the reflection fissures. And I mean, these are typically with data from NOSTAR, because NOSTAR is the most suitable X-ray emission for X-ray reflection spectroscopy. Then in magenta, there is this LMCX1, which is from the analysis of a thermal spectrum. And the constraint is weak because, as I said, there is a strong degeneracy between the estimate of a spin and the deformation parameter. And in blue, there are three special sources for which basically you can use the analysis of a reflection fissure and of the thermal spectrum at the same time. Either because the spectrum has both at the same time, or because you use you combine the analysis of spectra with strong reflection fissure and spectra with strong thermal spectra. And in the end, I mean, even if the analysis of the thermal spectrum itself provide weak constraint, if you combine the analysis of reflection spectrum and thermal spectrum, I mean, you obtain very precise measurement. Then in red, there is the best constraint from gravitational waves. I mean, there are many other constraints, but I mean, this is the best one. In cyan, there is the constraint from this MC 63015, so a supermassive black hole from the analysis of a reflection spectrum. And in this case, actually, the constraint seems to be comparable to the constraint from stellar mass black holes, but typically, supermassive black holes provide weaker constraints simply because they are dimmer. But MCG6315 is a very special case, I mean, with a very bright source, a very broad diode line, and then there are many observations, some of them are very high quality, and so for this reason, this constraint in cyan is comparable to the constraints in green. And then in gray, there are the constraints from black hole imaging, Sagittarius A star and M87 star. Which, for the moment, the constraints are much weaker than X-ray and gravitational waves. To improve the constraint by an order of magnitude, it is necessary, for example, that one of the telescopes is on space. And in this case, you can have a constraint comparable to gravitational waves and X-rays. So this is this is the summary for this deformation parameter alpha 1-3. Of course, this technique is very general, and it can be you can constrain other deformation parameters, or you can consider particular theory of gravity. Here we have some example, but there is no new physics. Basically, you just change the metric of a space-time, and you fit the data and you try to constrain the parameter of the model. Here we consider a few cases in which we know the uncharged rotating black hole solution. Here there is Einstein-Maxwell-Dilaton axion gravity, some black holes in conformal gravity, asymptotically safe gravity. Anyway, as I said, there is no really new physics. You repeat the same thing with a different metric. Then in one case it was the deformation parameter alpha 1-3. Here we have this gamma, but there is no anything new. Of course, as in any astrophysical measurement, the key point is the accuracy. In a sense, the precision is easy because depends eventually on the statistics. But the crucial question is about the accuracy. And here I have, this slide, as I wrote here, is a quick and personal answer about if these measurements are precise and accurate. So the point is that, as in any astrophysical measurement, it is also crucial to select the right source and the right observations, because these current models are simple. We should also use these models to try to fit the sources that meet the requirement for these models. So typically, you want these are requirement not only for if you want to test generativity, but even if you simply you want to measure the spin or I mean study the accretion disk. I mean you use these models for these reflection models. So it is important that most of the radiation comes from the very inner part of the accretion disk because this is the most informative part. So you want the spin is high, and the corona is compact and close to the black holes. So in this way, the inner edge of the disk can be close to the black hole, and the corona illuminates mainly the inner part of the accretion disk. Then, for example, you want the most informative part is in the shape of a row line. And so for this reason, you want to have a very prominent and broadened iron line. So for example, these exclude disk with a high ionization parameter. You need to be sure that the disk is thin. So typically the requirement is that the accretion luminosity is between 5% to 30% of the dental limit. And I mean, if you consider also an instrument, typically you want to have a good energy resolution near the row line because, as I said, the row line is the most informative part, but you need to measure all the full spectrum. So, for example, if you consider X-ray emission before NuSTAR, they were mainly sensitive, like XM Newton, Chandra, they were mainly sensitive only in the soft X-ray band, up to 10 keV. And in this case, basically, you were able only to measure the iron line. But for example, if you measure also the Compton amp, which is around 20-30 keV, you can measure much better the ionization parameter, and which in turn, I mean, help you to break the parameter degeneracy. And so, indeed, I mean, in the case of MCG6315, the source, I mean, the supermassive black hole for which, I mean, we have a good measurement, there are simultaneous observation, XM Newton, NuSTAR. Here I have, I mean, some slide about, I mean, basically we try to get an estimate of the uncertainty of some simplification model. So, for example, we have a model for a geometrically thin disk, but the disk has a fine thickness, and the thickness of the disk increases with the mass accretion rate. And our conclusion is that, I mean, in the end, as long as the disk is thin, I mean, the impact of the thickness is very small. On the other hand, I mean, if you consider thick disk, a polished donut model, which normally is supposed to be a good approximation for, I mean, a black hole created near the dental limit. So here, basically, we consider some simulations. I mean, we consider a model of this fat disk with a ray tracing technique. We calculated the reflection spectrum of this thick disk, and we fit the data with a thin disk model. And I mean, the result is that I mean, the systematic uncertainty are not under control. Which is, I mean, basically is just to stress that, you cannot simply, I mean, if you see a reflection model, some reflection feature in the source, basically, you fit the data with the reflection model, but basically the measurement has to be taken with caution because, I mean, of course, it depends also on, if the disk is thin or thick. And if it is thick, I mean, the systematic uncertainty can be very large. We consider also some geometry simulated disk, thin disk. So basically, I mean, you have some geometry simulation, you simulate a thin disk, again, with ray tracing technique, you calculate the reflection spectrum of this geometry simulated thin disk. You fit the data with your thin disk model. And I mean, even in this case, the conclusion is that, I mean, as long as the disk is thin, I mean, current reflection model work well. Then you consider also the radiation from the plunging region. return radiation. Actually, in the case of return radiation, I mean, the situation is a bit more complicated because it depends really on the location on the corona and geometry of the corona. But in the end, I mean, I would say that in conclusion, the common opinion is that if you select the right sources and the right observations, current reflection model are good enough to fit the data of current X-ray emission. A different story is on the end in the case of, future observations. So I arrive at the conclusion because my time is over. So basically, in the past year, we developed this model, RexNK and KBB, and I mean, we consider some test of generativity, this agnostic test or in the theory specific test. And work for the future is actually is not really correlated to the test of generativity. This is, in general, the work for the future in this field. So basically, I mean, like any astrophysical measurement, I mean, it is crucial to have the systematic under control. And and the idea is to try to develop more sophisticated, in particular, reflection models. Because if you consider the next generation of X-ray emission, which, I mean, the much better energy resolution and larger effective area, you expect that, I mean, if today the uncertainty is in the measurement is dominated by the statistical uncertainty in your photon count, with the next generation of X-ray emission, you expect that the systematic uncertainty rated on the model can be dominant, and so for this reason, I mean, the effort in the field is to develop more sophisticated reflection models. And thank you. I stop here.
So as has been the habit, we ask a lot of questions during the presentation, so I think we have time for one or two questions. We'll get back to yours at the end. So do we have any questions for Kasia? So I have one question about the systematics. We had a little bit of a discussion about thick versus thin disks. So the first question is, how would you imagine that we could support a thick disk with the kinds of densities that you would have at 20% or 30% Eddington when it should very effectively cool? And maybe the related question, aside from the theoretical consideration, is how valuable would it be to have the capacity to carefully and with high precision measure the UV spectrum, so that you could directly constrain the existence of thick disks in AGA?
Okay, I mean, about UV measurement. I'm not expert about UV, but I guess you want just to measure the mass accretion rate. I mean, you see the thermal spectrum, and I mean, you fit the thermal spectrum to infer the mass accretion rate. I don't know.
But the thermal spectrum, I mean, the reason why even the thermal spectrum could produce a flat emission, you know, flat observed spectrum, is because the multicolor black body, right? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be different if you have a thick disk, the inside of a cone versus a disk, different geometry produce a different.
Yes.
Right, so couldn't you directly address the geometry of the disk by itself without the complications of the reflection of the corona just by looking at the UV spectrum? I'm getting that's hard, but.
These are simply because there is dust absorption.
Okay. Also atmospheric absorption, so you need space based telescopes.
The point is that you can distinguish a thin disk from a thick disk. But actually, with the current reflection model, you should not fit the data of thick disk.
Yeah.
I mean, the model are for thin disk. So, I mean, this would be a model, a technique to say, okay, I should not fit the data.
Right. But, which is almost as good.
Okay.
Knowing when you're wrong is almost as good as knowing you're right. Okay, so then Cosmo will be here all day tomorrow. So if you want to chat with him about the things that he talks about or anything else that he works on, please do get in touch with him. And with that, let's thank Cosmo again.